unanimous, there is no unity by the scholars and even by different communities, and the same goes with Eid al-Fitr. Doesn't it affect the fasting that we are making? Because, you know, at least at the end of it, which is the Eid al-Fitr, fasting is forbidden and is haram. So if, for example, I follow this authority, this religious authority, and I'm not following the other, so what is my duty like? I'd be thankful if you shed some light. And is there any date to finalize all this dispute and controversial discussions for some time? Or no, we have to continue and keep up with that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that day would be the auspicious day of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. But
inshallah,
before that, it seems to for us to have this problem to be continued. But we should not think that it is only within the Shia communities and the followers of different Maraj al-Taqlid among the Shia. This is a problem for all the Muslims.
True.
And even it's not only a problem, I mean, from the side of the scholars. No, sometimes the problem is from the government and the countries. So to begin with, let me talk about the different criteria among different countries. In different countries, there are different criteria for announcing the lunar month, I mean the holy month of Ramadan and the month of Shawwal.
Mm-hmm.
Some countries only consider the sighting of the moon valid. Some rely on the astronomical calculations, not mm-hmm. sighting. Some consider both of them, I mean sighting and calculations. Some of the countries follow certain other Muslim countries. So each of these has different approaches regarding beginning of the holy month of Ramadan and the month of Shawwal. Again, for each and every one of them, still we have some differences. For example, when it comes to sighting the moon, some people believe in sighting the moon using naked eyes after the sunset of the day, which is previous to the first of the month. It seems to be practiced in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Morocco, and some. And this is the viewpoint of some Shia scholars. The other viewpoint is sighting the moon through, some tools, like, for example, binoculars, especially after the sunset of the day previous to the first day of the month. It's practiced in Iran and some. This is the viewpoint of some Shia scholars. The next viewpoint is the verdict of the court for sighting the crescent. It is mainly practiced in Saudi Arabia, and some countries follow these countries.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, some countries do not have any certain criteria, and they follow the announcement of the beginning of the month by other countries. For example, some countries follow Saudi Arabia, like Qatar, Emirates, Oman, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Afghanistan. Some small countries, they follow their bigger neighboring countries. For example, it's been mentioned that people in New Zealand, they follow people in Australia, or in Suriname, they follow Guyana. And some communities in non-Muslim countries, they follow some Islamic countries. So you see, I wanted just to shed the light on the fact that it's not only the problem for the followers of, for example, Ayatollah Khamenei and Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Makarem. No, this is a problem for all the countries. And even we see that is not, something which is not seen among the, Sunni scholars and Ahle Sunnah. Every year we see that even for the Sunnis, some countries, they announce one day as the first day of the month of Ramadan or the day of Eid al-Fitr, but other Sunni people, they announce another day.
Sheikhana, isn't it better for the Islam world to focus on this issue and reach to a conclusion and to reach to a solution for that? And it can be also a good factor for the unification of the Islamic Ummah. Why don't we pay attention to this issue? Yeah, it's true that it's not only among Shias, and all the Islamic sects and denominations are actually suffering from such a problem. So isn't it a good element for the Muslims to come to one unique decision in this regard? And on the other hand, it also affects the Knights of Qadr, which are very important knights to the Muslim and Islamic Ummah. And because by the different versions of the starting and ending of the month, so the exact nights of the Qadr are not clear to the people then. So is it a good solution to work on this?
You know, the point is that when it comes to, because in most of the cases, the difference is because of the fact that the scholars, both Shia and Sunni, they announce different days as the beginning of the month of Ramadan or the day of Eid al-Fitr.
Mm-hmm.
So why the scholars, they have differences? There are some reasons. First of all, there is a difference among the scholars whether when we sight the moon it should be with naked eyes or we can use some tools like telescopes and binoculars and so on and so forth. So some scholars believe that it should be with naked eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And some believe that no, we can use some astronomical tools. And it's a matter of dispute among the scholars. And both of them, they have arguments from the narrations. So we cannot blame one group and not blame the other. This is their viewpoint.
I know, Sheikh. Respecting their viewpoints and their fatwas and ahkam decrees, is it possible to make a unity in these viewpoints, to make it even one voice in the Islam world?
There are some ways. I will come to them, but whether they are practical or not is another issue. I will have some suggestion, but I don't think that at least all of them are practical nowadays. So the point is that there is a difference of idea. For example, the scholar A, he believes that it should be through the naked eyes. And mm-hmm. today, nobody has seen the moon through his naked eyes. So he cannot announce that this is the beginning of the month.
But does the unity of Muslim world worth to change their decree for the benefit of the Islamic unity?
I don't think so that he can change his idea, because if he comes to this conclusion that sighting should be through naked eyes, he cannot change his
mind. But there
mind.
Is a greater expediency, Sheikh, here.
For that, I will come to some solutions. For example, maybe that a scholar might stop declaring his viewpoint when he sees that the great majority of the scholars, they have announced another day. Mm-hmm. So it might be a solution, but whether these scholars are ready to accept that or not, this is another issue. The other reason for difference is that we know that every city, every region, every country has a shari'i so-called horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, the question is that if the moon is seen, for example, in Tehran, so is it valid for people in Pakistan, in Iraq, in Kuwait? So this is another matter of dispute among the scholars. Some believe that it could be valid for the same cities with the same Shari'i horizon, and some believe that no. So this is another reason why we have differences of idea among the Maraji'i Taqlid. The next issue is that the beginning of a month is proved through another different ways. A person sees the moon himself, a person relies on others seeing the moon, two just people, men, they say that they have witnessed the moon, and 30 days passing from the previous month, and the verdict of Hakim al-Shahr, the Muslim ruler, or as we put it, Wali Faqih. Now, when it comes to the last point, again, there is a matter of dispute among the scholars whether the verdict of a Wali Faqih should be followed by all the scholars or not. If it was the case that all the scholars, they agree, especially among the Shias, that all the Shia scholars, they agreed that if Hakim al-Shahr, Wali Faqih, he passes a verdict that this is the day of Eid, then it is incumbent upon all the people to follow him. Maybe we did not have all these problems. But again, the point is that this is a matter of dispute among the scholars. Some believe that no, every person should follow the viewpoint of his own Marja'i Taqlid. So, for example, if I follow Marjay Taqlid, who doesn't believe in the verdict of Wali Faqih to be valid for the beginning of the month. So naturally, I will follow his verdict and his viewpoint.
But how come the verdict of Wali Faqih can be accepted for all the followers of other Marajan authorities?
As I mentioned, this is a matter of dispute. Some scholars, they believe that the verdict of Marjay Taqlid is one of the ways to prove the beginning of the month.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is the viewpoint of that Marjay Taqlid and a scholar, then it means that if Wali Faqih passes a verdict that today is the beginning of the month, all the followers of other Maraji should follow him. But some of the Maraji, they do not believe in this. They do not believe in the fact that the verdict of the Wali Faqih is a valid way to prove the beginning of the month. And that is why it caused some differences and problems.
Very true.
The other reason that why we see some disagreements among the scholars is that, as I mentioned, one of the ways to prove the beginning of the month is the witnesses of some people. So, for example, there are two people, they say that we witness the moon. Now, the witness of these two people might be convincing, and these two people are trustworthy by some scholars, but other scholars do not regard these two people as trustworthy or their report as valid. So my point is that we should not think that it's not an easy matter. It's pretty complicated. There are different reasons why the Muslim scholars, both Shia and Sunni, they come to this disagreement. It's not limited to the Shia. It's both among the Shias and Sunnis. Another point is, comes from some of the so-called kings of some of the Islamic countries. In some cases, they announce one day as the beginning of a lunar month. It adds to the problem again. As I mentioned, we can think of some solutions. One, especially for the Shia, is for all the scholars to pay attention to the verdict of Wali Faqih. And let me also mention another point. Proving the new month and the beginning of a new month is upon every mukallaf.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for me, it is proved that this is the beginning of the month for the fact that Wali Faqih has announced it, then for me it is the beginning of the month, although my Marjay Taqlid has not announced it. So the best way might be for all the people to follow the verdict of Wali Faqih.
Mm-hmm.
The next solution is that other Maraji who have disagreement, they may not announce their viewpoint because they see, as you mentioned, it causes differences among the scholars. A third is that we can say that at the end of the day, if none of them is practical, then we can ask every person to act upon his duty. So for me, this is the day of Eid, so I pay Zakat al-Fitra, fasting is forbidden for me. For another person, this is the 30th day of the month of Ramadan, they fast, and every person respects the viewpoint of others.
Mm-hmm.
And the last solution is that those people for whom this is the 30th of the month of Ramadan, while for other people it is the day of Eid, maybe it's a good suggestion for them to go to a travel and not to fast on that very special day, and to make up to the qada later. So on that very special day, they are not going to be fasting as a matter of caution, because it might be the day of Eid. So they can join the people who are celebrating the day of Eid al-Fitr, eating and drinking, and then later they can make up for the fast.
So we can expect seeing Muslims in parks and in, I don't know, in trips at the ending days of the month.
Only for one day they go to some 22, 23 kilometers and then they come back to their home.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and good suggestions that you have just proposed. We have been talking, dear brothers and sisters, about the conflicts and, let's say, disputes among the scholars and Islamic denominations on the starting and ending days of the holy month of Ramadan. Dear brothers and sisters, my thanks for staying tuned and listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لن نخشى المحن
The Light
Thousand drones have lit up the sky of a northwestern Russian town in a dazzling show commemorating the country's victory in World War II. The drones flew in formation and displayed images related to the deadliest war in history. The show ended with a giant dove of peace flying above mesmerized spectators. Russia commemorates its victory day on May the 9th every year. There is also an annual parade which the authorities decided to postpone due to the coronavirus pandemic. Humans have used the services of honeybees for centuries. Now, Dutch scientists have found a way to get help from these small animals in detecting the coronavirus. Let's have a listen.
We take the bees from a honeybee keeper here in the region, and we use a set of bees every day, and we put those bees in harnesses to fix them, and then we present coronavirus positive and coronavirus negative samples. And after presenting a positive sample, we always present sugar water afterwards. So in the end, the bees extend their proboscis after being presented a coronavirus positive sample. And in that way, we can train bees pretty quickly.
The bees indicate a positive COVID-19 result by extending their tongue to drink a reward of sugar water. Using these insects as coronavirus testing tools can significantly shorten the time spent on waiting for the result of a COVID diagnosis. It can also be very important in countries where there is not enough infrastructure and testing. Bees have an unusually strong sense of smell. They have already been used in some parts of the world to detect explosives and toxins.
A recently installed pizza-making machine is pitting itself against masterful chefs in the Italian capital, Rome. The tall red machine has become a head-turner in the city, which is famous for its pizza, one of Italy's most iconic traditional dishes. The customers get to choose among four types of pizzas plus a drink. A few minutes after placing your order, you will receive the dish on a platter fresh out of the oven. But Italians say the pizza cannot compete with those made traditionally.
The true pizza is made from a wood oven. I wouldn't even take into consideration eating a pizza from a machine.
So far, the reception from people has been far from favorable. However, some say the final product can be acceptable considering its price or if you are in a hurry. As many countries accelerate their coronavirus vaccination programs, life is gradually getting back to normal. Now, residents of a nursing home in the Spanish capital, Madrid, finally get a chance to go out after months of isolation. Around 50 elderly residents and staff from two care homes went on an excursion to the Madrid Zoo after they were vaccinated against COVID-19. They visited some of the park's inhabitants, from pandas to elephants, while sitting on a miniature train. They hailed the idea, saying they were bored with staying at the nursing home with no visitors.
It's good to leave, to break the monotony of the nursing home, especially as we have been confined there for so long. It's nice to get outside, so I decided to go out and see the world.
The director of the care home believes the experience makes the residents forget about their pains. Around 43,000 seniors died of COVID-19 during the first wave of the pandemic in Spain. The elderly population was among the first group to receive coronavirus vaccines in the country. Now, looking for a cheaper and more sustainable alternative to traditional lawn mowers. Ship me may be the answer. Researchers at the University of California, Davis have embarked on a project to test the effectiveness of sheep as new lawn mowers. The project includes 25 sheep of 4 different breeds. They are going to graze on a 1-acre plot of pasture for 3 days. The process will be repeated after a month.
The sheep have been used for a couple of things. So they're as good as goats in reducing down the vegetation. So in areas where there is, it doesn't just have to be a lawn. If they're in their areas where there's overgrown and you've got sort of those higher fuel ladders, they can eat that down. But what they also do, so they can cut that out, but then they also can come around and after there's been a fire, they're really good at eating the weeds that come up initially, the weeds that we don't want, those invasive weeds.
Researchers believe that the initiative also has an environmental impact. With fewer mowers, there might be less emission. They also hope using sheep will help increase natural fertilization and nutrient levels.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Over the past few years, people have become more aware of the detrimental effect of littering to the environment. Bolivians have launched a nationwide campaign aimed at protecting the country's scenic spots and waterways from human waste. Hundreds of volunteers were seen cleaning up the Valley of the Souls near La Paz, which is famous for its unusual razor-sharp rock formations. The volunteers, aided by heavy machinery, managed to collect over 15 tons of plastic waste and construction rubble from the rocky canyon. Activist Carola says people needed to speak up more in defense of the nature, which is increasingly coming under threat.
It is incredible how we can find jewels like this painting amid all these piles of rubble and garbage, and we are surprised and ask what is going on with nature. It is a tourist place where many people come. The Valley of the Souls is very special, and many people have gathered together here to be a voice for nature and to get it the care and respect it deserves.
Last month, the campaign also cleared the highland lake of Uru in western Bolivia, which is said to be full of more plastic than water. Campaigners say they will continue their efforts until no place with garbage is left in the country. An exhibition in the Belgian province of Wallon-Brabant has put on display several objects belonging to French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte. A belt with the word Waterloo written on it, a flintlock pistol, Napoleon's shoe, bathtub, clothes, and several other objects are all displayed in the exhibition. Many of the items are brought from Napoleon's last residence on St. Helena Island. The curators say the exhibition aims to show Napoleon's daily life and the way he lived. Earlier this week, an auction was set up in France offering Napoleon's blood-stained cloth, estimated to be sold for $18,000. May 5th marks the 200th anniversary of Napoleon's death. people always try to find new ways to connect and support each other at the moment of crisis. A young Indian is one such example who is saving lives by providing free oxygen to coronavirus patients. 32-year-old Shanawaz Sheikh is a resident of India's commercial hub, Mumbai. He launched the campaign during the first wave of the pandemic when his friend's cousin died of COVID-19 on the way to hospital. Now popularly known as Oxygen Man, Shanawaz sold his car last June and used the money to buy oxygen cylinders for those in need. He and his team have now set up a control room to deliver oxygen to patients. They send the cylinder as soon as they receive a call from a COVID patient or a family.
Without oxygen, a patient can't live. They need it very badly, even in the ambulance on the way to hospital. If Shanawaz wasn't helping, patients would likely not even make it to hospitals. They would die on the way.
Shanawaz says his team helped nearly 5,000 people during the first wave of the pandemic last year and is planning to help as many as possible during the second wave. His initiative is earning him much praise on social media, with many calling Shanawaz and his team real heroes during the crisis.
Archaeologists have found a meaningful, mysterious new findings in a cave in Mexico. They believe they are part of ancient Maya rituals. Around 1,200 years ago, some people imprinted their hands on the cave walls. The 137 prints are in two colors, black and red. Experts say the black ones represent death, while the red paintings are a reference to war or life. An analysis of their size also shows that the handprints were likely made by children as they entered puberty. The subterranean cavern, called Chichen Itza, is located nearly 10 meters below a tree, which Mayans assume sacred. Little hotels for little bees. In Colombia, wooden structures are built for the insects to rest after a hard day. The Oboro Valley Metropolitan Authority has installed the hexagon-shaped rooms for bees of all shapes and sizes. Every day, volunteers clean the bamboo hotel with paintbrushes. Designers say the bee hotels are made to protect some species that are more vulnerable.
These little bees are supremely sensitive to poisons, and since they don't produce honey, no one speaks up for them. So we're coming to the rescue.
Designers say bees are losing their habitat all over the world, so the hotels could be a means of survival. Colombia has registered 550 varieties of bees within its borders.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son, he's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamu alaykum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of teenagers. And the answers are mostly based upon the Quran and the narrations of our beloved Imams alayhim as-salam. I'm Hasnain, and we have in the studio our guest speaker, Sheikh Farman Ali Ma'soumi. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiyaqom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Farman.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Brother Farman, one of our listeners has asked us about the love and affection with children and what are its limits.
Thank you so much. This is again a very, very important question. When you are facing your teenagers, you know, as yeah. I said, they are in this stage, maybe they become rude, maybe they don't listen to you.
Right.
So, and this stage, because of the change they feel in themselves, the physical change, the level of hormones also yeah. changes in this level, in this age. So because of these, they have some changes, you know, they suddenly become upset, they suddenly feel, become rude to you, you know, and they suddenly yeah. become disobedient uh-huh. towards you.
Yeah.
So we should not think that they are our enemies,
uh-huh.
you
yeah.
know, because unfortunately yeah, some not, yeah. parents, they can't control themselves, yeah. you know, they have some very, very serious and bad reactions towards their teenagers.
So they need to understand that it's just because of the hormonal
yeah, because
changes.
Of the changes they are facing. Yeah. It is not in their hands, you know.
True. It's natural.
It's natural. It's natural, and you have to handle them carefully.
Yeah.
So to handle them, they need more attention.
True.
So one of the things you have to do is you show the affection and love towards them, you know.
True.
You go and hug and kiss them. Even they reject you, you know. They don't want to stay with you in one house and one sofa and one, you know, room.
True. Yeah.
Don't think they have become your enemies.
True.
You know, they are your children. Because of these changes of the demand of this age, you know, teenage, because of these, they are showing some, you know, these things.
Yeah.
So in this age, we have to be very careful.
Right.
We have to pay extra attention towards them.
Right, yeah.
We have to take care of them very, very carefully and show more affection and love towards them. In one hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that you show love and affection to with your children, and if you promise them, you have to fulfill the promise, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
So showing your love and affection towards them is very important, although maybe they will not, you know, respond to you with the same love and affection
yeah.
at the moment
yeah.
or in that age.
Mm-hmm.
But it will have very, very good impact in their life. In one another hadith, the yeah. Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the Prophet of Mercy, says that whatever your teenagers do,
uh-huh.
you have to be patient and show your love towards them.
Allahu Akbar.
You know, and Imam Ali also in Nahjul Balagha says, "Mawaddatul Abai Qarabatun Bainal Abna."
Uh-huh.
You know, it has two, you know, aspects in this hadith,
mm-hmm.
hadith
yeah.
of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One is, if you are friends with, you know, if
yeah.
you have good relations with your friends,
mm-hmm.
so your sons will also have good relations with others, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Yeah.
By this, you can show your respect and love. Another meaning of this hadith is, if you become, you know, you have lovely relations with your teenagers,
yeah.
you show their love and affection, definitely they will have the same feelings with
true.
You.
True. Yeah. Thank yeah. you so much, Brother Farman. And dear audience, let's take a short break over here.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break, we're discussing about the different narrations from the Ma'asumin alayhim as-salam regarding love and affection for children. Brother Farman, please continue.
Yeah. So one of the scholars I was listening to his speech, he was saying that He had a teenager, and they went together to a gathering, you know, an important gathering. So in that gathering, I asked something from my, teenager boy.
Yeah.
But he didn't listen to me. He didn't obey me in front of all these people. You know, I became so much angry.
Yeah.
I felt that I was insulted.
Uh-huh.
But he said, from inside, I was happy that my son is, you know, he has a naturally life. He is normal. He's true. Not abnormal.
Uh-huh.
Because the demand of this age is like this. In somewhere, he has to show that he's disobeying you.
Uh-huh.
He is disrespectful towards you.
That's interesting.
You know, usually, but we parents, we try to make them always respectful, obedient, like, you know, like an adult we want them to be.
So basically what we do is, our fault is that we expect the behavior of adults from children.
We expect them to be like an adult, you know.
Yeah.
Like we in 40 years, we know all the, you know, rules and all the morals, and we have a lot of experience. So we expect from a teenager who is like, you know, in a hadith they say, kal aradil khaliya, you know, like empty soul, soil, empty soil, in on an empty earth, whatever you grow, it grows, no matter whatever you do.
Mm-hmm.
So likewise, your teenagers also lost. Their heart is empty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do not have this experience. So whatever you will put there,
they will catch
it.
Uh-huh, that's beautiful, yeah.
So we should not expect our teenagers to be very nice and very sober in this age.
Yeah,
it is not a good expectation.
True.
If they do mistakes, we should not punish them.
Yeah.
We should not show our anger toward them in front of others, especially. So, in a lot of ahadith and narrations, they have emphasized Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam and Imam Ali and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam also, that your teenager boy, your children, they can do mistakes.
That's right.
So don't be very harsh towards them.
Mm-hmm.
Keep some space there. Let them feel that you are not that much sensitive about their mistakes.
Yeah.
What I want to say is that if they commit a sin, God forbid, sometimes, do not be over-controlled. Do not be so hyper, so angry that you start, you know, shouting and punishing them in front of others or in front of, you know, your own family members, which is very, very dangerous.
Thank you so much, Brother Faman. And dear audience, let's take a short break over here.
Ya Muqiya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqiya al-Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it.
Welcome back, dear audience. And before the break, we were discussing that even if a child commits a mistake, if a sin, that we should not be harsh on them. So, Brother Faman, please continue.
Yeah, as I said, there are a lot of ahadiths. Just I will share some of the ahadiths.
Yeah.
That in another hadith, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Jahlu shabbi ma'zurun, ilmuhu mahqurun." You know, the mistakes of a teenager is ma'zur.
Yeah.
It is not completely a thing that you punish him. Ma'zur means forgiven. Because ilmuhu mahqur. Mahqur comes from haqir. Haqir means very less, very few, very, you know, less value, they say haqir. Because his knowledge is very, very limited.
True.
You know, he does not have that much knowledge, he does not have that much experience, because he has started his, you know, life.
True, yeah.
So we cannot expect them to be like 40, 50
years. Yeah, like adults, like grown-up adults. Yeah,
grown-up adults. No, no. That's why Imam says, give them this chance. You know, if let them do mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And your reaction should be very, very cautious towards teenagers because they are very sensitive.
True.
God forbid, do not in front of others especially be very careful and cautious by becoming angry and uttering some words. You know, you can destroy his confidence, his respect.
True.
So we have to be very, very careful. In another hadith, I think if I do not mistake, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Ash-shababu shu'batun min al-junun." Junun means insane, madness. Means this teenager age is age where they do sometimes, you know, very, very funny things.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Something like madful things they can do.
Yeah.
So we should keep this in our mind also. If we see that your teenager boy is doing something very extraordinarily funny or something else, something insane, so keep in mind that this is demand of this age. So there are a lot of other ahadith also. The most important thing is Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Usikum bishababi khaira." Always be kind towards them. You show your love and affection towards your teenagers, as I said in our previous lectures also, because they have a very, very soft and clean heart. So by becoming harsh or by disrespecting, you can destroy their hopes and you can have very, very bad impact in these clean hearts.
Sure.
So we have to take each and every single step
carefully.
Carefully and cautiously.
So thank you so much, Brother Farman, and thank you so much, dear audience, for staying with us. In this program, we discuss about teenagers. So talking about teenagers, it is a critical age due to hormonal changes. There might be different reactions and also we need to handle them with care. And we have looked into different narrations from Masumin alayhi salam where they ask us to show love and affection to our teenagers. So we need to be patient. And one of the common mistakes that parents have is having a lot of expectations from their children. Though they are teenagers, they expect them behavior of grown-up adults from their children, which is not right. And we looked into another narration where Imam says that even if they commit a sin, we shouldn't be harsh on them because they're just children. So we need to be careful and we need to be kind towards them. So basically speaking, we need to handle our children with love and care. Thank you so much, Brother Farman, and thank you so much to your audience for staying with us. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, farstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment, we're going to talk about some famous reciters of the Quran and the world of Islam. Today, I want to introduce you to a famous Iranian reciter, Brother Amin Pouya. This reciter was born in 1978 in Tehran. When he was 8 years old, his father started teaching him the Holy Quran, recitation of the Quran. For 6 years, he followed the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad. It's interesting to know that most reciters become familiar with the art of recitation of the Quran through Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad. The first recitation that they hear is usually a recitation by Sheikh Abdul Basit. That is why you will see that most good reciters begin their path to becoming a good reciter by following the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad. So he followed the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit for 6 years. After that, he started imitating the style of Sheikh Shahat Muhammad Anwar. And it's interesting that he utilizes both styles in his recitation even today. So we could say that he has invented a new style which includes both the style of Abdul Basit and also the style of Shahat Muhammad Anwar. And then, of course, he started listening to other prominent reciters of the Quran, such as Sheikh Mustafa Ismail and Ahmad Shabib. Brother Amin Pouya has participated in many national and international competitions. He placed second several times in the national competitions in Iran, and he was sent to participate in other countries, Quran competitions in other countries. And it's interesting that he placed first in almost all of them, except for the Malaysian competition, which he placed second. But in Tunisia, India, Russia, and other countries, he managed to place first in those competitions. One thing with Brother Amin Pouya, and generally speaking, all other Quran reciters from Iran, is that they have a good knowledge of the maqamat. That is, they learn the maqamat and then use them in their recitation. Some reciters don't have knowledge of maqamat, and they just recite different maqams without knowing them. But Iranian reciters, most of them know the maqamat that they use. Now let's listen to Surah At-Tawbah, verses 122 to 123 by Brother Amin Puya. Let's enjoy this recitation.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وما كان المؤمنون لينفروا كافة فلولا نفر من كل فرقة منهم طائفة ليتفقهوا في الدين ولينذروا قومهم إذا رجعوا إليهم ولينذروا قومهم إذا رجعوا إليهم لعلهم يحذرون. يا واعلموا أن الله مع المتقين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
And it is not for the believers to go forth to battle all at once. For there should separate from every division of them a group remaining to obtain understanding in the religion and warn their people when they return to them that they might be cautious. O you who have believed, fight those adjacent to you of the disbelievers and let them find in you harshness and know that Allah is with the righteous.
The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is John and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the International Quds Day across the subcontinent. And we shall take a look at the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians and the role of world's Muslims and non-Muslims in the actualization of the Palestinian cause.
Since 1947, when the British Mandate ended on Palestine, Israel has committed crimes against the Palestinians that are unprecedented in modern history. Palestinians are humiliated, kidnapped, tortured, and killed in their own land while struggling with this new type of colonization in the name of settlements. Many global organizations, including the European Union, the United Nations, and the International Court of Justice, recognize these settlements as illegal, but nobody seems to do anything about them.
Every year on the International Quds Day, Muslims and non-Muslims across the subcontinent hold protests to further the Palestinian cause and end the Israeli occupation. Quds Day is an opportunity to unite all the Islamic community behind this beacon of hope and leads the Ummah to subcontinental unity and even global unison. However, Palestinians remain one of the most oppressed communities in the world, while the world tends to remain silent. Many countries and governments that call themselves torchbearers of freedom and liberty are silent. Even though US has vetoed more than 20 UN resolutions for Israel and bullied most governments into remaining silent, millions of people from all around the world, including the subcontinent, mark the International Quds Day as a symbol of resistance and protest against the illegitimate Israeli regime and its crimes against the Palestinians.
What we see in Iran and its neighboring countries and some of the European and West countries where some substantial number of Muslims are residing for a couple of decades there. The voice in favor of Palestine under the banner of Quds Day has been gradually increased, which is a very, very good sign.
The fate of the Palestinian cause is especially interconnected with the people of the Asian plateau. The history of occupation and exploitation in the western and eastern parts of the continent share uncanny similarities. The Indian subcontinent can play a vital role in better actualization of the Palestinian cause. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims who have been supporting a free Palestine for a long time, myriads of ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the region have also voiced some sort of support for it.
Every Quds Day, millions of people all around the world, including the West, hold large protest rallies against the policies of the Zionist regime. Although the COVID pandemic has made many of these protests virtual, the agony in the lives of Palestinians has become more real. The heinous crimes of Israel are not emotionally charged overstatements. Israeli oppression is well documented. Only in 2014 alone, more than 2,300 Palestinians were killed, and so far, more than 65,000 Palestinian citizens are said to have been killed by the Israeli forces in total. Gaza is under complete blockade since 2007. Almost 2 million people are under constant threat of bombardment of even their schools and hospitals. They face a famine with no money or clean water amid the deadly outbreak of the coronavirus. Then, when Palestinians protest, Israeli forces mercilessly fire live ammunition at them, killing children, women, journalists, medical aid workers, and even handicapped people. Israel has now increased the occupation of the West Bank territory. Israelis keep forcing native Arab Muslims out of their homes before bulldozing their property, only to build new settlements. They do this even though the settlements are considered illegal, and Israel has been declared an apartheid regime by UN and prominent international leaders, as well as human rights organizations from all around the world.
Seeing Quds Day as the great unifier that it is can also help find more feasible solutions for other problems of the subcontinental Islamic population. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and the rest of South Asia act as one. With that scope of support and cooperation, even the complex, intractable issues of the Muslim world, including Kashmir or Rohingya, seem solvable.
Since the early years of the 20th century, colonial powers have been masters of the so-called divide and rule dogma to prolong their rule. The partition of Palestine to create the Zionist entity in the midst of the 20th century occurred just 1 year after British India was partitioned to create Pakistan. It is always seen as the legacy of British imperialism in South Asia. The Israeli regime illegitimately and illegally took control of Palestine with the help of imperial super